Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. Our guest today will be Andrea Morthodon from Great Britain. From New Zealand, we'll hear from Blair Anderson of the Mild Greens. From Canada, we'll hear from Chris Bennett of Pot TV, and we'll be hearing from half a dozen of our Drug Truth Network reporters. First up, we hear from New Zealand, Mr. Blair Anderson.
Well, hello there, Dean. Thanks for having me on your show. I'm, of course, from the Mild Greens here in New Zealand, and we advocate on drug policy, representing both our national interests in reform and, of course, assisting those people on an international basis.
Now, Blair, as we're doing this recording, it's near the world anniversary date for Anti-Drug Day. And, of course, they shot dozens of people in China, and various locales have celebrated the occasion, so to speak. What's happening down in New Zealand?
Well, of course, it barely rated a mention here, World Anti-Drugs Day. And you're quite right about this issue having an international context. Of course, New Zealand does look forward to a free trade agreement with China where the issue is discussed at a human rights level, as it is in other jurisdictions as well. But there never seems to be a connection to the drug debate, and a shameful comment by Kofi Annan, the head of the United Nations, that, you know, drug use is a dead end. It certainly is when you are applying bullets to the neck, as they're doing in southern China.
I talked to a young lady today out of Great Britain, and she made a reference to the fact that she considers Great Britain to be the 51st of the United States. We have a lot of impact, a lot of reach out across the world on this drug war. How does it impact New Zealand?
Well, there's a couple of things that distinguish New Zealand from the United States in the way in which we've advanced the debate here. We were pioneers here in New Zealand of the needle exchange concept in terms of limiting the harms of blood-borne diseases. And I see that the United Nations has made a further call, as have the other US interests, applying pressure on governments worldwide to curtail their needle exchange programs because it just promotes drug use. So, yes, we're affected by all this kind of international context of the imposition of a value system, which is essentially a moral one, which seems to be U.S.-centric.
What progress might be made this year? Where are your thoughts for progress in New Zealand?
Well, New Zealand has a three-year standing agreement that in the current term of Parliament, they won't move on the cannabis issue. So that shut down the debate for 3 years. Fortunately, although the election date hasn't been set yet, we're facing an election probably about mid-September, and the drug debate is going to be one of the forefront issues, despite the media, or in spite of the media ignoring it, because the parties that are contesting the election have quite strong and divergent views. We have a Green Party with our eminent Rasta man, Nandor Tenchos, representing the cannabis issue in the House. But we also have a number of other people who are currently in the play politically, who have a very family values orientated mission, and theirs, of course, is a prohibitionist line in the sand and sending a clear message. So I don't have a great deal of confidence that much will change, but the outcome of the election will be all important, and from there we'll know which direction to steer in.
The way I understand it, the United Nations is wanting to allow needle exchange as part of their their endeavors to help prevent the spread of AIDS and other diseases?
Not according to the most recent report I received this morning, Dean, and that's a very disturbing factor, that this is a campaign being led by the U.S. to curtail the use of needle exchange. It's quite the perverse opposite of a harm reduction, harm minimization method. The context of the debate internationally is very important. I don't believe that the United States is going to solve its drug policy problem until it's recognized internationally that their position is unsustainable. The endeavor that I genuinely feel is that the interests in reform in the United States would be, you know, better placed, if you like, resourcing the reform at an international level. And the review of the UN is now on the table, and this is an opportunity worldwide to bring the drug debate to the fore. The mere suggestion from the United Nations, the UNODC, Office of Drug Control, has linked mild use of cannabis to terrorism, and this is the most absurd and toxic propaganda. I mean, I know that propaganda pervades the debate, but this is really where the evidence is now before anybody in reform. To change the law, we're going to have to challenge it ethically at the Court of Human Rights. We have to make it impossible for the United Nations to maintain this rhetoric in spite of evidence-based policy.
Tell us about how the perception, the run-up to the Iraqi war might compare to the situation for the drug war.
The distortion of truth and you know, beguiling of people is it's happening on a global scale. The consent of nation states to go to war twice into Iraq. But clearly, when you have got a misinformed public, the destabilization of nation states on a global scale can be attributable to, and indeed laid at the feet of, prohibition. The arms, drugs, money laundering issue came up here in the South Pacific at a special meeting held by the stakeholders, the police and customs and so forth, you know, waxing lyrical as to how bad the problem is and how they're under-resourced to do anything about it. That very same mechanism is at the foot of problems in Asia, in Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, or in fact all the stands along that sector of southern Russia are corrupted by the war on drugs, the artificial values given to green and white agricultural substances. Whether that you're talking about the Balkans, the northern area of South America, whether you're talking about here in the South Pacific, Southeast Asia, the corruption that underpins this, and it's even accepted in the Chappelle Corby case, the young lass in Bali prison, 20 years for possession of someone else's pot. The essence of that has been reduced to where the lawyers were seeking $500,000 to bribe the judges, suggesting that it's not only corrupt, but it's institutionally corrupt. So the way to change this is to get everybody that's in reform to recognize that we are a long way from where we were 10 years ago. We wouldn't have had this conversation 10 years ago because cheap phone calls, internet, and so forth allows us to do this. We must understand that while the media has been beguiling us for many, many years on drug prohibition and its efficacy, you know, sort of the notion that somehow prohibition is safe, it is now up for question with the United Nations also under review. We should, as a global community, recognize that not only is our communication far more intimate and effective and our monitoring of the media so complete, by the way, the likes of Map News and so forth, but we are the media. We can change this. And it's only now a question of recognizing how best to mobilize that with these upcoming events. I mean, the review of the United Nations is an opportunity on a global scale to put prohibition to the test, and we should do so.
Indeed, we must put prohibition to the test. And now, here from Great Britain is Andrea.
My name is Andrea Athenia Mordaunt. I'm a harm reduction worker in United Kingdom, based in London. And in 1996, I founded a small project called the John Mordaunt Trust. John was my life partner, who became a great human rights and drugs activist in this country. He died from AIDS in 95, sadly. So I wanted to create a structure where other drug users and ex-users could organize to improve treatment for themselves and other parts of their lives, and of course their social conditions, and ultimately actually start asking very important questions about whether there is any value in the prohibitive system that we have at the moment.
Just this morning, I saw an email indicating that the United States is going to allow now for needle exchange as part of that program.
Well, that's that's fantastic. I feel like jumping for joy, actually, because we were just in March at the UN meeting, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, which is the policymaking wing of the UN, because the US had clearly instructed the UN not to support those programs. So this is really, really wonderful news. Thank you so much. You've made my life, actually, never mind my day. I mean, this is where I come into all of this, as an advocate.
What is the general attitude, outlook, in Great Britain? Are they going to re-criminalize marijuana, other drugs? What's going on?
Right. Well, there's going to be some kind of commission in the autumn about this, but I must admit that I'm rather afraid that they're going to declassify it to Schedule B again. There will be some sort of decision. Well, this is what I've been told by those in the know by the end of the year, but it's very difficult to know for certain because, as was with the drugs bill, it was quickly passed through when most people who did know a lot about drug policy, who do know a lot about drug policy in this country, felt it was just a, you know, PR job. It was a political thing to actually, you know, because governments over here know that they can win elections by being tough on drugs and tough on crime.
What motivates you to do the work you do?
Many things. Of course, the dying and deaths of many people, not just John, my late husband, but also one particular guy, in fact, was a Southern Baptist from the States, and he asked me clearly in his dying days to be a witness to what I was seeing happening to his body as he died. And this kind of stuff is constantly ringing in my ears when I'm, you know, fighting for harm reduction and advocating for my peers to make sure that those diseases, which are completely preventable, don't have to happen to them, because they don't. It's as simple as that.
And I thank Andrea for joining us on Cultural Baggage. Her website is usersvoice.org.uk.
The U.S. government has been pressuring U.N. agencies to renounce needle exchanges and other harm reduction programs. In opposing needle exchanges and refusing to fund such programs, the U.S. government increases the spread of AIDS and hepatitis C. Fortunately, the U.N. Joint Committee on HIV/AIDS endorsed needle exchanges in its progress report issued June 29th. Unfortunately, the U.N. Office on Drugs and Crime, known as UNODC, dropped its support for needle exchanges in its annual report issued the same day. UNODC's stated goals have merit: getting injection drug users to stop injecting, getting other users to stop using, getting sexually active people to stop having unprotected sex. Yet, there are no immediate miracles. In the meantime, people are dying. The bottom line, condoms and clean needles save lives and help prevent disease. The U.S. government may have lost a battle, but all of humanity won. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, just how many people does the world need dying of AIDS and hepatitis? This is such a no-brainer that yesterday's Dear Abby was titled, Sex with Drug Addict Could Lead to Disease. It seems Dear Abby got a letter from a nurse who was disappointed that she didn't mention that having sex with a drug addict is a recipe for getting AIDS and many other sexually transmitted diseases. Abby responded, quote, "Your letter makes me wonder how many lives could be saved if clean needle exchange programs were available in every city," end quote. We're going to take our midpoint break right here, but when we come back, we'll hear from Vancouver's Chris Bennett and Pot TV.
It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects.
Impaired mental and or physical abilities, heart failure, severe kidney and liver disease, increased cerebral spinal fluid pressure, intracranial lesions, convulsions, and respiratory malformations of the fetus in utero. Time's up. The answer, codeine. And of course, with symptoms like that, it's approved by the FDA. Drug prohibition. 90 years of success. Lead us to this day. Our children pick up the phone and drugs are delivered within the hour. Because that's how we like it. Overdose deaths, preventable by a phone call, are assured by paranoia. Yes, we are number one. Violent drug gangs are the scourge of our continent. We insist that their jobs pay so very well. Terrorists turn flowers into million-dollar bankrolls to buy bigger weapons to kill us. So each year, we give them $500 billion to make it so. We are the champions of the world. We're using the war of terror and the war on drugs to spread more democracy around this world than many folks ever thought possible. Out of approximately 160 nations on planet Earth, we got troops in about 140 of them taking care of democracy. I'm going to calm down. Here's Chris Bennett.
Okay, my name's Chris Bennett. I'm the husband of Renee Beaujean, Canadian husband, and the father of our child, Shiva. Been wanting to, you know, see my wife stay here in Canada with me, where we are very involved in the cannabis reform movement. I run Pot TV and do other projects here in Canada relating to cannabis reform.
Now, Chris, the U.S. authorities are leaning on the Canadian authorities, trying to drag your wife back to the States. What's going on with that?
Well, you know, there's a witch hunt taking place here in with the U.S. authorities, the Bush administration, the Christian American Taliban, as I like to call them, have a real hate on for people involved in the cannabis reform movement or medical marijuana movement. We can see evidence of that in the federal persecution of people like Renee. The federal government down there has probably spent millions of dollars pursuing Renee in Canada for allegedly watering some plants. And due to the massive amount of trade and other relations that the Canadian government relies on for America, the Canadian government has been only too willing to not acknowledge things like the Human Rights Watch's complaints about American prisons and other groups' complaints about American prisons, even though in Canada we have a federal legal medical marijuana program. And in the United States, there's no acknowledgement of medical marijuana. They've decided to basically use Renee's life as a gold coin of commerce and have her shipped back to America, where she'll go into custody and then go through a kangaroo court trial where she won't be allowed to present any sort of medical defense and will likely face a minimum mandatory sentence of 10 years.
Now, there was a recent hearing in this regard. Tell us how that...
What happened is, Renee's case was before the Canadian Justice Minister, kind of the counterpart of the Attorney General in the U.S. and Canada. And unlike Justice Ministers who had sat on the case before the latest Justice Minister, Erwin Kotler, and there have been two or three who sat on this case for a number of years at the time, Erwin Kotler, shortly after getting elected and in the midst of numerous Canadian scandals involving the government that must have been taking his attention, found the time to put together a 19-page dismissal of Renee's claim for refugee status based on her situation, and virtually dismissing it on every single angle that we put forth, not taking into account the damage this is going to do to our three-year-old son if he has his mother ripped away from him, and not to take into consideration that what Renee did wouldn't really be considered a crime here in Canada, and even in a maximum case scenario, it might be like a couple years in jail, nowhere near the draconian penalty she faces if she's sent back to America.
What is her status at this time?
Well, right now, Renee's out on bail pending judicial review. She has to return back and give herself back up for custody on September 30th. By that time, her lawyers hope to have an appeal in place questioning a number of questions of law in the Justice Minister's decision against Renee.
Well, Chris, the focus of this week's cultural baggage is the U.S. mandate, the U.S. Mandated Single Conventions Treaty on Narcotics, and how it impacts nations around the world. Your thoughts on that, sir?
Well, I other countries are involved in the Single Convention Treaty that have not got the draconian situation that's taking place in America and to some extent in Canada. Places like Holland are Single Convention Treaty members, Spain, I believe, as well. And these countries have taken a different approach and are taking a different approach. The pressure, I would say, isn't coming from the UN. If it's coming from the UN, it's indirectly. It's more coming from the United States. And it's pressure and control of the UN, and it's pressure and control globally.
And now this from the LA Times. The Bush administration and congressional allies are gearing up to renew a plan for drug eradication in Latin America, despite some grim news. The $5.4 billion spent on the plan since 2000 has made no dent in the availability of cocaine on American streets, and prices are at an all-time low. That was printed on Wednesday, but then on Thursday we hear this. A U.S. House Appropriations Subcommittee shot down a $150 million request to increase funding to Colombia for its coca spraying program. This according to the Miami Sun-Herald. They too say that despite heavy spraying, Colombia has seen a negligible reduction in coca production. End quote. And of course, we've exported that success to an even bigger success in Afghanistan. Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
This week, an editorial in the Florida Ledger asked the question, quote, America rescued Afghanistan from the Taliban. Now who will rescue America from Afghanistan's heroin? Since the U.S. occupation began in 2001, Afghan heroin production has increased an astonishing 123-fold. Last year's bumper crop of poppy was without precedent. Afghanistan now produces about 90% of the world's heroin, and according to the U.S. Department of Justice, has now become America's second largest supplier. Last Sunday was the UN International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking. Afghan authorities marked the day by burning more than 60 tons of illegal drugs in massive bonfires throughout the country. In an eerie parallel, Amnesty International, the Christian Science Monitor, and Radio Free Europe all report that last year, as many as several hundred Afghani women doused themselves with gasoline and set themselves on fire. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
It's obvious these problems stem from vast and widespread corruption.
This is Phil Smith with this week's Corrupt Cop Story for the Drug Truth Network. This week we're going to sunny Daytona Beach, Florida, where a Volusia County Sheriff's Department civilian employee was sentenced to 3 years in prison on June 23rd for stealing more than $1 million worth of drugs from the department's evidence room. Timothy Wallace, age 48, pleaded guilty in April to charges of official misconduct and conspiracy to traffic cocaine. But the Daytona Beach News Journal reported that angry Wallace family members said he was forced into a plea deal and was being scapegoated. Oddly enough, while he faced up to 30 years in prison, Assistant State Attorney Jean Status asked for only 3. She told the newspaper she made that sentencing recommendation at the request of the Sheriff's Department. She also said Wallace could have received even less time. For stealing $1 million worth of police dope? Hell, a guy fell on a rock of crack in Florida to get more time than that. As always, there are more corrupt cop stories this week. Check them out online at the Drug War Chronicle at stopthedrugwar.org.
3 years for $1 million worth of stolen police drugs. Hell, I spent a month in jail one time for 0.023 grams of marijuana.
Today I want to talk about the eminent domain ruling from the Supreme Court and the drug war. The Supreme Court last Thursday ruled that local governments may seize people's homes and businesses, even against their will, for private economic development. The case pitted the city of New London, Connecticut, against homeowner Suzette Kilo and 6 other families who were trying to keep the municipality from condemning their homes for use as part of a redevelopment project centered around a $270 million global research facility built by the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer. This is an unbelievable decision, but it's what's been happening to us disguised as asset forfeiture and carried out under the drug war for years. To me, this is a classic example of, I told you, if they take away my rights, they will eventually take away yours. And I would like to encourage all drug policy reformers and others who care about this issue to see this opportunity and point out the parallels. I also find it really ironic that Pfizer will get the land in the New London, Connecticut case, because if you, regular citizen, have drugs in your house, the government can come and take your house, your kids, and put you in jail for those drugs. However, if a multi-billion dollar pharmaceutical giant wants your property so they can make drugs there, they're now in the clear to take it. And if the Bush administration gets their way, the government can forcibly drug your children. This world has gone absolutely mad. This is Loretta Nall reporting for the U.S. Marijuana Party. Until next time, y'all be safe and stay out of jail.
Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. Could a hotel be built on the land owned by Supreme Court Justice David Souter? A new ruling by the Supreme Court, which was supported by him, might allow it. A private developer is seeking to use this very law to build a hotel at the site of Souter's home. The proposed development, called the Lost Liberty Hotel, will feature the Just Desserts Cafe and include a museum open to the public featuring a permanent exhibit on the loss of freedom in America. This next story from Providence, Rhode Island. The governor on Wednesday vetoed a medical marijuana bill that enjoyed strong support in both chambers of the General Assembly. The bill would protect from prosecution seriously ill people who had a doctor's recommendation that marijuana could help. In his veto message, Governor Don Carcieri said the bill is flawed and could encourage marijuana abuse. On Friday, July 1st, the Rhode Island Senate has already overridden the governor's veto, and it now goes to the House for final approval to allow medical marijuana. I think Winston Francis has been studying Little W's speeches.
Let's talk seriously about the drug war. Drug legalization advocates claim that they have the constitutional right to do coke off a knife at their PTA meetings. But the reality is that the government's greatest responsibility is to protect its citizens. America is leading a global war to rid society of the cancer that is drug addiction. Drugs and drug addiction spread crime and corruption and undermine freedom and justice. We see this to be true in places like Mexico, Colombia, Afghanistan, and many places here at home. So we must be vigilant, and we must be victorious. This mission will take courage and sacrifice. Many look at the growing number of arrests each year and ask, is it worth the sacrifice? It is worth it. We are removing a source of violence and addiction and laying a foundation of prosperity and hope for our children and grandchildren. History teaches us that a society cannot survive if it is corrupt and decadent. The government's commitment to the American people is that this great nation will not fall. We will defend our freedom. Prosperity and hope cannot exist in a society enslaved by addiction. It is worth it, and it is vital to our nation's future and indeed the future of the global community. The government fights so that we can be free. This has been Winston Francis with the official Government Truth.
Yeah, right, Winston. Free to spend 10 years in prison for some negligible amount of drugs. Some quick program notes. The DOT Award, the amount we're willing to give a drug warrior for coming on our show, has now increased to $1,000. This award was named after my recently deceased mother, DOT. Our guest for next week, attorney Jeff Blackburn. We're going to slice and dice the crime labs and the district attorney's offices all across this nation. And as always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT in Houston. Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.